Welcome to the School of Arts, School of the Arts. Our choice of this marvelous place was deliberate. Each day, the School of Arts cultivates the talents of our city's youth. Now, that's a good school, full of good kids with good teachers, and it's not the only one in this city. And it's important to remember that. It's important to remember that despite the challenges that our school district faces. So thanks to SOTA and the Rochester School District for being our host tonight. And I'd be remiss, of course, if I didn't thank you. Thank you. The citizens of the city of Rochester, I appreciate your support. It's been an honor and a privilege to be the mayor of this city. I've had some jobs in my life, but this has been the most rewarding. Sometimes the most challenging, but also the most rewarding. And I appreciate you being here tonight. Shows you're interested in the city, shows you're interested in this place, and that's important to me. It's important, obviously, to this city. I've just completed my second year as mayor, and we've accomplished much and have set in motion a great deal for the transformation of this city, of our city, Rochester. But I can't do it in a vacuum, and I'm grateful for the partners in service who make this possible. Our Congresswoman, Louise Slaughter, our Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, to Governor Andrew Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy, whose efforts have assisted Rochester in very difficult economic times. And also for the teaching us that the functioning of New York government can actually happen. My thanks to the Assembly delegation, Assemblyman David Gant, Joe Morelli, Harry Bronson, the Senate delegation, Senators Joe Robach, Ted O'Brien, and Michael Runzenhofer. And thanks to our community partners, County Executive Maggie Brooks, who's here tonight, and the County Legislature. And my sincere appreciation goes out to the city employees. City employees are an important part of what makes this place go. They work hard, and we don't want to forget about them. And, of course, the City Council, who's here tonight. City Council President Lovely Warren, Vice President Dana Miller, and Council Members Carolee Conklin, Matt Haig, Adam McFadden, Jackie Ortiz, Carla Palumbo, Loretta Scott, and Elaine Spall, whose district we sit in tonight. We've worked with a cooperative and collaborative spirit to address the challenges that face our city, and it's been important to us. My thanks also to Bogan Vargas, who's here tonight, and the school board president, Malik Evans, and the other members of the board. I think we have an excellent partner in making this city better, and that's important, as I will talk about here in a while. And finally, to my family, my wife, Betty, who's here, my sister's here as well, and my grandchildren, who don't take me very seriously, and therefore accepted my role as grandfather, so therefore they keep me kind of grounded here and don't get too impressed, even though I've met Spider-Man. This is a unique time in the history of our city. We are seeing a fundamental change in our circumstances. The old politics of making promises and ignoring the obvious realities are over. We need a new politics of governing for our city, and we need to begin to remake our city, not by pretending that the new world doesn't exist, but rather by pulling together and facing our new reality with new policies and new actions. And with the right leadership and the collective will, we can make our city a place where all of our residents have an opportunity to thrive and prosper. Tonight, I want to focus on that new reality that we face and what we should do about it, or what I think we should do about it. We're a city undergoing a transformation. Some of this is due to the factors that have gripped cities all across the country. They include the loss of the industrial base that was largely concentrated in cities and was the source of stable employment for its citizens. Employment that required skills and commitment, but not significant levels of education and preparation. We are seeing a shift to a knowledge-based economy that is no longer rooted in the large industrial facilities that were tied to a place. The economy places a premium on education and technical skills. Our society has seen a shift to suburban living and suburban employment. That suburban shift has fostered a change in transportation and infrastructure all around us. And the recent prolonged recession and its impacts have confirmed these economic changes that have been occurring over some time. Some of this transformation is due to factors that are peculiar, or particular rather, to our community. We depended on a few large companies and were dominated by one in particular. And they provided the employment and the civic leadership This dynamic has not existed for some time, and the Kodak bankruptcy provides symbolic evidence of that. These industries were always relatively high tech, and attracted people with transferable skills. Downsizing often brought separation plans that were relatively generous for those affected. The shift in the economic base that affected many cities was more gradual and, to some extent, milder here. Nonetheless, the change was real, and it has had a real impact. As a result of all this and other things as well, we are a changed city. We were built for 330,000 people, and we're now 210,000 people. Kodak no longer employs 60,000 people here. It is not just that we are smaller. We are, in fact, different. There's a dichotomy between a significant part of the city and the suburbs in wealth, in public education performance, and in race. Our city has one of the highest concentrations of poverty in the state, if not in the country, and that, too, is disproportionately defined by race. Our school system is struggling at a time when there's a premium on education, and with large annual budget gaps, it's increasingly difficult to fund our government. We are at a place where just two state mandates completely swallow our entire property tax. The city's dynamics, its industrial base, its population base, and its traditional funding streams are forever changed. So there's no doubt that we're a city being transformed. This is not a choice, it's a fact. Our choice is whether this transformation will be for good or ill. Our choice is whether we will control it or whether it will control us. I say these things, some of which are not so pleasant to hear, quite frankly, not to scare or discourage you, but in the firm belief that if we're to take charge of our future, we need to understand and be honest about our present. I seek to get out in front and to steer this transformation so that all of us can remain and prosper in this city we love. My intention tonight is to show that we've started down that path and how I think we can continue. As a start, I see two key risks that could lead us astray. The first is that we fail to understand what's going on, to mistake the change as one of degree rather than transformation, to mistake it as a matter of size rather than fundamental difference. In the face of the new and uncertain reality, I understand the temptation to trivialize the challenges, particularly the financial challenges, and to substitute sort of a traditional laundry list of promises or benefits to one individual or group. This strategy may sound good, particularly to the recipient, but we are way past that point. That's the old politics, and we need new politics of transformation. The second key risk is to not allow the changes to isolate the city and its people. There's a temptation to turn inward, to define the city in isolation, to define it in terms of one segment or one race or one problem, and to use that definition to political advantage. There are cities all across this country that have tried that approach, and none have succeeded. A campaign can be won by that strategy, but a city cannot be governed that way. Again, that's the old politics, and as far as I'm concerned, a certain path to failure. Successful cities have always had a constituency broader than themselves. In the last century, they earned it as the center of the broader community, and to no small extent, we're going to have to earn it again. We need to be seen as more than a place where some of us live and work. We are and need to be recognized as the cultural and financial center of the region. We need a broad spectrum of people to identify with the city, its success, and its future. And we need those people to proudly say they are from Rochester, whether they happen to live in its boundaries or not. This is no time to narrow the definition of our city. So how are we going to go about that? We start with public safety. Perhaps the most fundamental purpose of the government is the protection of its citizens. By far, the lion's share of the city's budget is dedicated to the police and fire services. But That is far from the full extent of our investment in public safety. Clean water, street lighting, lead safe and affordable housing, code inspections, after-school programs, rec centers, libraries, all are pieces of the puzzle that keep our citizens safe. But despite this investment and despite our vigilance, some of our citizens prey upon others and participate in violent activities. Those activities violate not just the individual victim, but they violate us all. A neighborhood infringed upon by violence damages us all. While it's a fact that violent crime has been steadily decreasing, that's of little value to someone who's been a victim of it, who has witnessed it. These past months, Chief Shepherd and I have participated in the Voice of the Citizen, or VOC, about violence and crime. They were well attended by citizens who had their concerns and ideas of how we could deal with it. And some of those ideas we're already acting on, some are already in progress, and others we're taking a good hard look at. I want to thank each of the people who came there and gave their time and attention to it. It, quite frankly, is very reassuring for the Chief and I to see that kind of interest. But it taught us what we probably knew already, and that is we need the citizens to help. And in fact, just last month, there was a successful arrest of some violent people because some people in the neighborhood decided they'd had it, and they stuck up with it, and they helped the police do it. After the summer's, with the summer fast approaching, we need to pay attention to the potential for escalating violence. Last summer, we met this with a variety of strategies called Operation Cool Down, and we've already started this year. We're looking at it from a more comprehensive point of view. We are approaching crime and violence from three perspectives. First, engaging neighborhoods, then engaging young people, and then engaging gangs, targeting gangs. We will do these under the umbrella of Chief Shepherd's policing in the spirit of service. Being a police officer is a tough job. You're asked to deal with many of the things that the rest of us don't want to deal with, or maybe we can't deal with. It can be dangerous and often thankless. Being a cop is tough because despite these pressures that you encounter on the job, you are expected not to let them affect your performance. I believe that's part of what the Chief is saying when he says policing in the spirit of service. And I admire the men and women who live this day in and day out. Whatever our response to crime and violence, we cannot lose sight of this principle. And so, with respect to the first part of the plan, engaging neighbors, I believe Chief Shepherd is doing an excellent job of reaching out, including his chief on the street meetings and barbershop talks, several of which I've attended. As a result of those experiences in our VOC meetings, we've seen the importance of citizen input and collaboration. They are convinced, and so am I, that we can be successful in this incorporating them in the process. And therefore, in the forthcoming budget, I have set aside money for a competitive grant for neighborhood groups and organizations to develop plans to work with the police to stem violence and criminal activities in their neighborhoods. This is sort of a new form of citizen budgeting. There are no predetermined outcomes for those grants. We'll work to figure out whatever is best, and the neighborhood and the residents will decide what they think we should do. Maybe it goes to a camera. Maybe it goes to a more efficient plan for reporting things. Maybe something else in the neighborhood that they think will impact this. The second part, engaging young people. A particularly unfortunate part of the problem is the involvement of young people. The police department has directly addressed this by engaging youth in the Police Activities League and other interactive programs that involve children. This builds a bond of trust by working to improve the police and youth relations, and by training our young people for jobs, we cannot resist the temptation to participate in those activities that lead to crime and violence. However, this is not just a police department problem. We must focus on keeping our young people occupied with gainful activities, and one of the best activities I can think of is a job. Thanks to Senator Robach, we have $250,000 to bolster our Summer of Opportunity Fund. In the upcoming budget, we're going to invest another $300,000, and that will affect 400 jobs for city residents this summer. And this is combined with the Rochester Work Summer Youth Employment Program, which has 500 youth in it, and, of course, the Hillside Work Scholarship Program that operates all through the year. This should have a significant impact because the Summer of Opportunity Program is not just a job. It's a program that encourages education, that matches youth with job opportunities, encourages them to complete school, and gives them a real life experience that they can carry on beyond that so that they become more competitive in our society and more committed to improving themselves through education. Targeting gangs. As we talk about this problem, we need to continually remind ourselves that crime, particularly violent crime, results from the actions of a very small number of people. Most people, no matter where they live or how old they are, want to live their lives peaceably, and that is, in fact, how they live their daily lives. However, there are far too many illegal guns on our streets, and those guns are in the hands of a relatively small number of young, self-identified gang members. These gangs or street clubs are involved in drug sales and other illegal activity, and they use their weapons to defend their turf and settle scores, often trivial scores, with other people. The chief confirms that most of the gun crimes in our city stem from this kind of activity. We will use all of the tools in our disposal to break up these gangs. Just last month, the RPD, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the County DA's Office, ATF, and I see the district attorney here and the sheriff here tonight, who participated in that process, had a major bust of gangs, and it resulted in 11 arrests of people who were terrorizing a neighborhood. And we're going to keep it up until people realize that this is not the way to go. You may remember that recently the chief sent out a notice to people who we know to be engaged in this activity and let them know we know it and let them know they're on our radar. There's been a lot of discussion lately about the formulation of how police are deployed. Some prefer the current East-West division. Some would like to go back to seven sections, the arrangement we had here once upon a time. I don't necessarily buy that public safety was better under the section system. We had significant police-citizen issues in that time, and the crime rates were, in fact, higher, and in some of our response times were, in fact, longer. But I don't dismiss the fact that there are well-reasoned opinions that say that there are differences in the way we ought to deploy our police. This includes the possibility that it would improve the relationships with the police and the community. But however, we need to think before we do it. We need to think before we spend the money on sections to make sure that this is the best way to accomplish that goal. And this is a discussion that needs to be based not on nostalgia or emotion. It needs to be based on facts and to be thoroughly reviewed. We've created recently the downtown district, which is a response to the rapidly changing downtown. It operates generally during the daytime when there are 50,000 people who come downtown each day and making it the most densely populated section of our city. Some of those people live there, some work there, and all types of jobs. Some are in school and some are just passing through in the bus. Those police resources are there because that's where the people are and where the demand exists. Thereafter, those resources are shifted to other parts of the city. We're responding to a fact-based need, and we're maintaining the flexibility to respond elsewhere. And that's the kind of consideration that we're going to have to bring to other changes. To that end, I will include in the budget this time some funding to study the RPO arrangement and to see whether or not this is something we need to change, and if so, how we need to change it. We're not alone in this. People all across the country are dealing with this, and we should benefit from the knowledge they have about it. Closely tied to public safety and almost everything else we aspire to is the public education system. In the past, the conversation about the school district throughout too much of our community has been dominated by adults who are often competing for center stage by one-upping each other about who can be the most critical. We have endured repeated changes in our district leadership and one grand plan after another that promised to solve it all. The children, unfortunately, were often pawns in an adult game. I have sought a new course. It does not back off for a minute for the need for dramatic improvement and accountability for us all. It is, however, one of active, cooperative participation with the school district. And I believe I have willing partners in the superintendent, in the board, and in the unions. As a start, no points are awarded for trashing the district. Everybody knows, including the people directly responsible for it, that it needs to improve. And it's too late for anybody to claim they just discovered it. The issue at hand is what we do about it. Our children, some 30,000 of them, continue to move through the system. They cannot wait for us to get organized and put an allegedly perfect plan in place. Our students often struggle because they come from unstable circumstances, and we shouldn't repeat those circumstances in school. School should be stable, something children can count on. This means consistent programs in consistent locations with consistent leadership. We need fewer programs done well. The district must be credible, and it starts with the basics, like taking attendance and enforcing it. You can't benefit from any program if you're not there. It starts in the beginning, and kindergarten, so that the practice is ingrained and the child doesn't drift behind. And we've actively participated with the district on this issue. Our children must learn to master the basics, like learning to read by third grade, so they can read to learn thereafter. And this, by the way, is one of those things, unlike some of these other challenges we have, that we actually know how to do if we put ourselves at it. I support universally available preschool and an extended school day. We should have the longest school day in the county, not the shortest. And and it should include enrichment, sports, music, arts, some of which we've lost. The schools that are being rebuilt under the Facilities Modernization Program should accommodate this, and the city can help through the development of community schools that support a broad range of community needs. We have studies underway now to see how our libraries and rec centers can coordinate and support such a program. There are charter schools in our city, and there will be more, some of which are being actively planned now. I support this as a necessary option for our families, just as the Catholic school system was once a necessary option. However, in the end, I'm the mayor of the city of Rochester, and I have a primary obligation to the Rochester public school system. There will be tens of thousands of children in our public school system for the foreseeable future, and I have no intention of giving up on them. None of this puts the mayor in charge of the school system or tells it how to educate our children. That's the district's clear responsibility. The major programs I've mentioned are all announced intention to the districts already. What I have done and what I propose to continue to do uses a collaborative approach to put the children first. And in all of this struggle and attention to our problems, I'd ask us to remember that it does not take away from our commitment to improvement to acknowledge the good things about our children, their families, and their teachers. I join Superintendent Bohan Vargas and Board President Evans to visit the home of some students who, in the early grades, who were experiencing attendance problems. However, we shouldn't forget that almost 10,000 children in our system have excellent or nearly perfect attendance, which is 97%. And at the superintendent's suggestion, we visited the homes of some of these children to present a certificate. If you have perfect attendance in the second grade, somebody is making sure you get there. And so we recognize the parents and the guardians as well. We have to find a way to reinforce the fact that the way to show you love your children is to get them to school. Schools can only flourish in neighborhoods that are strong. and I pledge to keep investing in our neighborhoods and expand our affordable housing efforts to improve the quality of life. This upcoming year, you will see work begin on the new Public Market storefront building, and you'll see complete work at the Sunhouse Housing Project in the Northeast. In the Northwest, the Holy Rosia campus and its infill housing element will be completed, and the work will begin on the FOTEC site. In the Southeast quadrant, you can begin to see work on College Town, and you'll see work on the second phase of the Culver Road Armory. The Pinnacle Apartments renovation will be completed. And in the Southwest, the flats at Brooks Landing will be underway, and the Carriage Factory, Hardy Apartments, and Cornhill Townhouses will be completed. Let's talk a little bit about where the money goes. Big projects in the center city get the most attention, but it's important to remember that our primary commitment is to our neighborhoods. The obvious examples include the many people and facilities in our police, fire, 311, and emergency communication centers. But remember, our rec centers, our libraries, our neighborhood service centers, all of them are centered in the neighborhoods. Our staff that maintains the parks, that picks up the refuse and the recycling, plows the streets, keeps the sidewalks clean, lead inspectors, code enforcement officers, animal service people, our business and housing development, our planning, zoning, and neighborhood preservation people, the Water Bureau, employment opportunities and youth services. A list of staff services goes on and on. We are a very engaged city. In the last 4 years, we've invested more than $24 million in personnel to support programs in recreation and youth services, $33 million in personnel for our libraries, $137 million in people who maintain our roads, sidewalks, and similar things, and $465 million in public safety for police, fire, and 911. Why do we make such significant commitments in our neighborhoods when there's challenges for our finances? Why do we make sure the libraries and rec centers remain funded? Because in the city, if we don't provide those services, our residents will go without them. For example, our libraries have become safe havens for children, offering programs and structured activities. City libraries host programs like Safe to Be Smart, which provides cultural and literacy-related field trips, life skills, trainings, community service activities, and guest speakers. The youth workers and librarians serve as counselors, tutors, mentors to these children. Take a 16-year-old boy who comes into the Phyllis Wheatley Library with his 11-year-old brother every day. His parents are from Somalia, and they don't speak English. They come there to get help with their homework, and they're excited to see a sign-up board there that says a field trip to the RPO. What's an RPO, they say. Their interaction with the library opens up for them a whole new world. Significant program commitments in our neighborhoods are vital for the positive impacts they have on people. Officer Brandon Ince, from a young age, his parents instilled in him the value of giving back to a community. The sense of the community stayed with him, and it serves our city. He serves our city not only in uniform, but as a volunteer with the Police Activities League. He has a special connection with kids. He grew up on the West Side. He experienced the same things and what these kids are going through today. And the volunteering helps him strengthen his commitment or his connection with citizens. And for those youth, their connection with the police department. We continue to invest in our neighborhoods and our family. Over the last 4 years, the public and private investment in infrastructure, housing, and business development in Rochester is more than $1.7 billion. That's B with a billion, folks. Now, It has been a very long time, since this city has seen that kind of investment. And it is only occurring because the city has become an active partner. For example, in real estate developments, every city dollar attracts more than $20 from other sources. Our investments include roadway resurfacing so that residents and visitors have a safe place to drive, sidewalk and curb replacements, street lighting, great places to walk, bike, and run, park and trail reinforcements, environmental green improvements, all things so our citizens can enjoy this community. It includes the water system so that our families have clean, healthy, reliable drinking water. And we invest public money in our public facilities and infrastructure in every quadrant. In the Southwest, or Southeast, excuse me, over the last 4 years, there's been more than $102 million in investments. You can see it at Akron Street. You can see it at Cedarwood Terrace, Mount Hope Avenue, Melville Street, and Art Walk. In the Southwest, more than $47 million have been invested in infrastructure, and you can see it at Westfield Street, Aberdeen Street, South Clinton, and South Plymouth Avenues. In the Northeast, there's more than $84 million invested, and you can see it in the David Gant Community Center, the Smith Street Bridge, Joseph Avenue, and Avenue D. And in the Northwest, more than $78 million has been invested, and you can see it in street replacements along Dewey Avenue, Westchester Avenue, Emerson Street, and the new Spray Park in Edgerton. These are just a few examples of each in each area of our city. We need to remember, we are an older city. There's great virtue in that. We have great bones, we have interesting buildings, we have lots of assets here. But we need to invest in it. It needs care and nurturing, and we need to continue to invest. And if you stop, it shows right away. And I know you can go places, other cities, you can find them in New York for that matter, where they've stopped, and it soon shows. And what that says to people, that says, you're pulling out. You've given up. And maybe that's what I should do too. And so this isn't just a matter of making it look good. It's a matter of it being good. And that's an important reason why we have made this kind of commitment in times when it's tough. In addition, let's look at improving houses in our neighborhoods. Over the last 4 years, beyond the 350 units of market-rate housing, we've assisted more than 4,700 people of low and moderate income by creating new units, rehabilitating existing units, performing lead hazard controls. In all, 4,700 families have benefited. 4,700 families whose quality of life has been improved, and 4,700 families who are now living in safe, affordable housing. Much of our investment goes to providing safer housing for people, such as housing development, emergency assistance, exterior repair in the focused investment area, Home Rochester, and lead control. In short, we're providing our residents and our children and our families, those with disabilities and low income, with clean and safe homes that they can afford to live in. And the total investment in housing in the last 4 years is truly immense. We have been particularly successful in getting the support of through state housing programs, and this, along with an excellent group of developers in the city who are involved in affordable housing, has produced great success, success that is unique in the state. In the Northeast Quadrant, over the last 4 years, there's been more than $62 million in housing development, including El Camino and Mildred Johnson Estates and the Sun House, to name a few. In the Southwest, more than $112 million has been invested in housing, Voters Block, Brooks Court, and the Carriage Factory Apartments. Again, these are just a few. In the Southeast, more than $163 million has been invested in housing at Erie Harbor, the Hamilton, Norton, and Fernwood Villages. And in the Northwest, more than $79 million has been invested in housing in such places as Eastman Commons, Clay Avenue, and in the Josana neighborhood. We also cultivate city businesses in those neighborhoods, from mom-and-pop stores to manufacturing facilities. They improve the neighborhood and generate jobs that enhance the community and keep people employed. In the Northeast, over the last 4 years, we've invested more than $25 million in businesses, or more than $25 million have been invested, I should say. Just as the El Pion restaurant, Upstate Furniture Company, and Clemens Grocery. In the Southwest, more than $19 million has been invested in businesses. Brooks Landing Business Center, the Protech of Rochester. In the Southeast, more than $226 million has been invested. Look at College Town, the Culver Road Armory, Alexander Park, Highland Contractors, and the Freedom Market. And in the Northwest, more than $78 million has been invested, and you can see it in the main four General Supply, Mercury Print, and Warner Industries. These investments have paid off, and they are investments. Since 2004, the assessed value of the homes and businesses in Rochester has risen 14%. And we did it in the teeth of the worst recession we've had in a very long time. And that hasn't happened in this community in a very long time. It's been a good 20 years since we've been increasing our assessment. As an example, we've changed the nature of the High Falls District, and the assessed value of the property there rose by 53%, and the properties surrounding the new investments in High Falls rose almost 40%. Our residential investments also cause a ripple effect. The Home Rochester program commissioned a study of the impacts of its work on neighboring property values, and the results show that the Home Rochester program significantly boosts the value of neighboring properties by eliminating, in an obvious way, the blighting effect of vacant properties and introducing attractive owner-occupied homes. Rochester homes boost the value of the surrounding properties, or Home Rochester homes, boost them by almost $15,000, a little over $15,000. I want to show you a sample of how this is impacting our people and our neighborhoods. We'll start in the Southwest. Look behind me, you will see the federal Frederick Douglass Apartments, and across the street, part of the Voters Block community. They're part of an extensive rehab on West Main Street. These attractive and affordable apartments and first-floor commercial spaces will bring economic vitality to this gateway to downtown. This $27 million investment touches an entire neighborhood. Together, that will provide homes for 120 families and places for 12 businesses in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood, near the site where she and 15 others voted illegally in 1872. And what you are seeing is the cafe named the 1872 Cafe in Voters Block. This is part of a building that is also the home of 39 families that overlooks the site of the Susan B. Anthony Memorial that's now being designed by artist Pepsi Ketevong and will soon be there. These developments on West Main Street are affording residents a new start, residents like Betty Smith.
And I'm glad that the Voters Block got this area for a lot of us that are here that didn't want the big house. We just wanted something easy that we don't have to take care of, and everything is so accessible to us while we are here. And I love the laundry room, too, that are here. You don't have to go out the door for anything except, and I don't even have to go that far to work. I don't even have to drive to work. I walk 3 minutes to work. And how easier can that get for you?
Now we move to the Northeast, where we find the Genesee Brewery and its new brew house. The brew house is a symbol of the resurgence of the brewery in recent years. What's really important there, the brew house is nice, and we'll enjoy it, as you'll see, but really what is important is the brewery itself, which was almost gone, has almost doubled its employment. We took a chance on them, and it paid off, and we're very pleased with the result. And I should say that's a chance that the county participated in as well. So we both took a chance on them, and it paid off for both of us. We've worked actively with the brewery to transform that brew house into a destination location for upstate New York and beyond. It captures 135-year history of the brewery itself, but it also provides a magnificent view of the High Falls, the place where this city began. It's an attractive addition to the neighborhood that was supported by the net residents who participated in the approval process. I'm proud of our efforts to make this and to bring it to fruition, and proud of the brewery for the job they've done to bring themselves back. And here's the CEO of American Breweries.
We expect to have 250,000 visitors here at this center in a part of town that people didn't come to visit before. It allows us to explain how beer is made. The great thing, too, is we've created 64 jobs in a section of the city that really needs economic development. The other thing it's done is really improve our neighborhood.
In the Northwest, we see the Holy Rosary campus. This historic church was totally repurposed into affordable apartments and a vital community center for the neighborhood. The redevelopment also includes 25 homes throughout the Edgerton neighborhood. These additions and enhancement will generate new opportunities for the residents and the community. Their families are a great addition to the Dewey Driving Park-focused investment area. The apartments and homes are for individuals and families earning less than $25,000. And it's next door to the Price Right Grocery that opened a few years ago. And it's more evidence of the fact that these investments are, in fact, creating a neighborhood. This particular project, to me, is emblematic of what we need to do. When Holy Rosary Parish was going, and it's a beautiful complex if you've ever been there, it was the center of that neighborhood. It was part of the infrastructure of that neighborhood in many, many ways. But it's been closed for a while and was headed for an undetermined place. And, of course, it wasn't just closed as a building. It no longer was that community center. And so when I talk about how we need to sort of repurpose ourselves, how we need to transform ourselves, what you see here in this project is, in fact, not just a nice building and some nice apartments. You see another community center. You see that physical presence being now what it once was and what it can be as an anchor for that neighborhood. This, to me, is a great project to that emblifies that sort of thing. And so and I'd like you to hear from Juan Sanchez, who's one of the first residents.
I'm going to be the first one moving into this apartment. I'll be moving in on the 1st of May. I'm really excited to move in here. This is the first time I've ever lived in a brand new apartment. I'm actually the first one walking into these rugs. And I can't wait for me to move in.
You're lucky, Juan. In our house, if it was the first person to walk on the rug, I would never have been allowed to walk on it. So good for you. Finally, in the southeast, we see the view of a resurgent South Avenue. This avenue has once again become a mixed-use community that we can hope for all of the commercial corridors in our city. Behind me is South Avenue and Hickory Place. This is a residential and retail building that has 33 apartments with affordable housing component. The building breathed new life into the neighborhood. And this effort, again, is not just about the bricks that were laid a few years ago. It's about the effort to set the stage for many new businesses to open and thrive and provide jobs. Places like Zacks Avenue, Surface Salon, Full Moon Vista Bike Shop, and across the street, there's Hedonist Chocolates and Harry G's New York Deli. The South Wedge is thriving, and many thanks go to the tireless efforts of the Planning Committee from the South Wedge and the Business Association for the South Wedge. We spoke to Jennifer Posey at Hedonist Chocolates about her impression.
It's great to be a business owner in the South Wedge. A lot of new things have happened in the 7 years that we've been here. A lot of new businesses, places to eat, places to drink, places to shop. We were just a little business when we started, little teeny business, just me, and that was it. And now we have a staff of 10 people, and we have lots of other people that work, do jobs for us.
She makes some pretty mean chocolate there, too, if you haven't tried it. The essence of a city is the combination of its neighborhoods and business activity. And we have a classic example in our midst in Eastman Business Park, which was the principal manufacturing facility for Eastman Kodak. And it was the economic engine that created the neighborhoods that surround it. With the changes at Kodak, it's become critical to ensure that Eastman Business Park is maintained and can again be an economic driver for our city. And we can't take it for granted. Remember I said we're not just smaller, we're different. So Eastman Kodak is not going to take care of this. We're going to have to take care of it. And I'm working with Monroe County, and Maggie's been active in it. The New York State itself, which we hope to be a principal help in it, including the Finger Lakes Regional Development Council, Kodak, and the businesses who are located there now, that we can count on it. So we can count on it being a magnet in the future for attracting expanding companies. The future of this park is vital to our economic well-being. Today, there are about 6,000 people working in the park. Less than half of them work for Eastman Kodak. And that's the idea of where we're going and where we need to go to be successful. Just like Eastman Business Park, our city is an economic engine, not just for Rochester, but for the greater Rochester area. It's our business, social, and cultural center. As I said before, 50,000 people come down there each day to work, visit, and conduct business. Downtown's everybody's neighborhood. And we're making significant progress in making it successful. In the last 4 years, $104 million in city and public funding has driven a total of $606 million invested in downtown, and the transformation is evident everywhere. And to stop for a minute here, I think it's also a lesson for us in the sense of when you get into a situation like we got in downtown, let's face it, we were stuck. Midtown was essentially empty. The tower had been closed for years. The area was deteriorating. We were stuck. Somebody has to go first. Somebody has to go first. And in that set of circumstances, the city had to go first. Because one thing I've learned in this job, nobody cares like we do. As much as all the other governments and all the other things want to help us, they go home at night. We're there. And we need to remember that. And this is an example of it, I think. From Midtown Rising to Bridge Square to the Sibley Building to the Transit Center to Nothnagel Headquarters and the Trolley Barn, to name a few. Midtown Rising will see the completion of infrastructure improvements and a return to a street grid with green space, places for people to congregate, parcels for development. Windstream employees will be moving into the new headquarters in the next few months. Work will begin on the Midtown Tower, where people and families can live and businesses can set up shop. Elsewhere downtown, you see action at the RIT Center for Entrepreneurship, the Cox Building, and the new Hilton Garden Hotel. People are coming back to live in the Center City. With both market rate and affordable options, the Center City is a living, breathing place to be now. New residents are filling up the renovated Andrews Terrace, the Mills at High Falls, North Plymouth Terrace, and the Kirstein Building. With developments such as this, people imagine that almost all of our effort goes down there. In fact, it's the opposite. For every dollar we invest in the Center City, $2 are invested in our neighborhood, where our people live and raise their families. And you have seen ample evidence of this in the presentation I've showed you here. But all of these investments are working together to benefit the city as a whole. And it is a whole, and it needs to benefit itself that way. We're also working to ensure that these investments are creating jobs, jobs for our minority and city residents who can share in the opportunities that I've talked about here. The city has had a minority opportunity programs. However, we haven't been particularly satisfied with the results. Since I took office and since we've been working on this for a while, even before then, we initiated the city's first project labor agreement, or PLA, for Midtown Rising Project. And with the support of others, including many members on council who have been very active in it, we've managed to convince the people at the Facilities Modernization Program and also the Transit Center to use a similar program. The PLA is an agreement with organized labor and contractors to complete a project at a lower cost for taxpayers. And as part of that, we insisted, and the unions and the contractors and the other people agreed, that minorities and city residents have to share in the jobs that are created. That's part of what Bob Brown was talking about. That's part of what Bob Brown was talking about, and he was a leader in that. And something that they're entitled to some credit here, because traditionally I think the unions have been viewed as resistant to this, as part of the problem. And in fact, the difference in this PLA, the big difference as far as I'm concerned, is they signed on and took responsibility for it. In other words, they're invested in the outcome now. It's not what somebody else had to do. Maybe they'd cooperate, maybe they wouldn't. It's what they have to do, along with the rest of us. That's a big step by them. It's not easy to do. It takes leadership within the unions, and they're entitled to some credit for it. And this has been the first time in our history when we brought labor and contractors in the city together to create a job training program for city residents and minorities. And this program is supported by the building trades. The idea here is to provide a trained workforce and have someone not just get a job, but have the opportunity to get a career, to get in the union, to be an apprentice, to go somewhere not just on this project, but projects beyond it. And as we gain confidence with these programs, and there have been some ups and downs with them, we're working to include them in a broader spectrum of programs in this, that the city's involved in. College Town and the flats at Brook Landing are two in which we are going to do this. We've also addressed an historic problem with respect to minority representation in the city's public safety ranks. This is an issue that has vexed mayors for decades. The historic barriers to women and minorities and the rigid civil service system made it seem to be impossible. And this, of course, has a meaning, doesn't it, in this case, way beyond just equity in jobs. We need to have a public safety force that is representative of our community. And so it had to change. It had to change. And a group of people, including many members on council, the police and fire officials and other city employees, set about making this change. And we changed the whole process, the way we recruited, the way we tested, the way we did things. So we weren't looking for an excuse here. We were looking for an outcome. And the result has been a breakthrough in minority representation in both the police and fire academies. For the first time ever, women and minorities are the majority in our latest recruit classes. Percent of the current police academy and 57% of the current fire academy are minorities and women. And I'm proud to announce that this summer the city will collaborate with the University of Rochester to conduct a two-day career training and citywide job fair that's with other major employers. This event is designed to improve minority employment in the city. It will provide workshops and job training as well as instruction on resumes, job search, and testing for the civil service jobs so that they're prepared for the opportunities that will be presented by the employers who are there.
This is member-supported public radio, WXXI AM Rochester and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
From Dunn, and I know that. We intend, however, to stay with it, and we think we have some tools, as I've described here, and some programs that will allow us to begin to have a breakthrough result. One thing we need to accept, while it's not adequate what we've done, and there's more work to be done, we have had more success in the last 3 or 4 years than we've had in the last decade. So these programs, I think, will lead us, I hope, to a breakthrough in our public safety recruit classes, and we can write a new chapter, as I think we've already started to do. I began this speech by talking about the transformational change in funding for our city. I said we can't pretend that our financial situation does not exist. We can no longer rely on the old politics of shifting money around to individuals and groups. For example, we began this fiscal year with an almost $43 million shortfall out of a budget of about $500 million that would apply to this. We lowered that gap to $28 million by reducing our capital expenses, creating a self-insured health plan with the cooperation of our unions, and we're benefiting from an early retirement program we created several years ago. The details of how we will address the remaining shortfall in the coming year will be part of the budget presentation that will be out at the end of next week. But I can tell you it'll take some pain, and it'll take some resolve. Numbers of this size don't go away easily. And I can guarantee that the shortfall will be tens of millions of dollars once again in the following year. This underscores the need for fundamental changes that we need to make. Our transformation will require that we move away from the old politics of dependent upon the antiquated property tax. Our discussion should not be about how we allocate dwindling funds pitting residents against each other. That's the old politics. Rather, we should discuss on how we're going to preserve the fundamental services of urban life that our citizens want and need. It's important, I think, to remember what cities do. Cities provide, in their essence, the fundamental services that people depend on. I don't do a lot of things that are luxuries. I don't start wars. I don't go other places and pick fights. You know, I have to make sure the trash gets picked up, the policeman comes when someone calls, and the fire truck comes when you call. Most of what cities do are the essence of government services. And so we need to address this issue with that in mind. We need to make sure that the quality of life and the reason that people live in urban areas, the reason that they live in cities, are maintained. We can solve this problem with arithmetic by cutting the budget, but that will not make this a city we want to be in. And that's why we need to attack the structural financial problem that we have here. I'm going to seek a new relationship with the state to develop the 21st century plan to finance cities. The governor has created a committee that's supposed to address that, and I'm going to be all over them because I think it's very important. You know, and I don't expect, none of us expect to solve this problem all at once. That's why we're going through a lot of the trouble that we're going through right now and the push and the shove to make sure that we maintain the stability of our city. But it's high time that we acknowledge the issues and get started on a permanent solution, or we will rue the day we didn't do it. Everything I have done in the past 2 years as mayor has been towards one goal: to successfully guide our city through the transformation I have discussed. We haven't presented tonight all that's been accomplished to claim that the job is done, that we've solved every problem, cured every ill, reached every person. No city could claim that. Our intention was to show that much can be done in the face of significant obstacles. And that is the basis for our faith that we will, in fact, transform this city. That is the basis on which to assert that it is no time to turn away. I have sought to lead this city's transformation so that all of our residents can participate fully in the future. And to participate in the future, we need to be safe, we need to be educated, and we need to make investments in our city. And we need to do this together. Citizens, unions, city employees, city council, the school district, neighborhood and business groups, investors, educated, all of us. If you come away with anything tonight, it is that we are a city in transformation. I believe we have made much progress despite our challenges and have confidence in our ability to shape the future. We will decide, you and I, we will decide which way this transformation will go from here. I stand for the new politics, a new way of governing in the 21st century, facing the realities. Rochester is on a path of growth and stability with opportunities to prosper for all of our citizens. United with that goal, we can successfully transform Rochester. I ask you to join me.